content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are in our second reading from the July 1st, July 8th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine. We will start with a shorter main story that we didn't pick up last week. Russia decries unprecedented Olympic ban. What happened? Olympic officials this week ordered independent drug testing of all Russian athletes competing in the Rio de Janeiro Summer Games after the country's track and field team was barred from competing based on evidence of a massive government-run doping program, a punishment without precedent in Olympic history. Track and field's global oversight body voted unanimously last week to suspend the Russian team, which won 18 medals at the 2012 Games, because of a systematic and deeply rooted culture of performance-enhancing drug use. The integrity of Russian athletes has been under question for months after the former director of the country's anti-doping lab came forward to say that he'd led a large-scale doping scheme before and during the 2014 Sochi Winter Olympics. Russian athletes were allegedly given cocktails of banned substances, and their tainted urine samples were secretly swapped with clean ones. At a special summit this week, the International Olympic Committee upheld the Russian track team's ban and extended the drug testing requirement to Russian athletes in all sports, as well as to those from Kenya, which is also embroiled in a doping scandal. Russian officials vowed to appeal to an international sports arbitration board and suggested the ban was part of a Western plot. President Vladimir Putin called the decision unjust, of course, and the chairman of the Russian Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee, Alexei Pushkov, alleged the ruling was an act of political revenge against Russia for its independent foreign policy. What the columnist said: Russia's ban is undoubtedly a cause for celebration, said Tim Layden in SportsIllustrated.com. Not every Russian athlete doped, to be sure, but the testing culture there was at best broken and at worst wantonly corrupt. But Kenya? Their gifted and graceful distance runners have long been seen as beacons of purity. Sadly, this may just be the beginning of the dirty revelations. The Rio ban won't be enough to drag Putin's Russia out of the dark ages and toward a transparent and modern sporting infrastructure, said Ian Herbert in The Independent. That would require entirely ostracizing Russian sport. Yet we've already seen the creep of compromise. Olympic officials may yet allow a handful of Russian runners who train outside the country to compete in Rio, provided they pass drug tests. Even that tiny loophole is unacceptable. A regime that serially cheats is a stain on sport. Until that changes, let it remain a pariah state. It would not be a tragedy if these were the last Olympics, said Phil Rosenthal in the Chicago Tribune. The IOC pretends the games are a noble pageant, but Rio will be a global showcase for the Zika virus, fear of which drove Irish golfer Rory McIlroy to withdraw this week. Doping, sewage-polluted waterways, terrorism fears, crass commercialism, and a corrupt host nation near economic collapse. The games will make tons of money for TV networks, sponsors, and the IOC, but there must be a better way to determine who appears on a box of cornflakes. And a couple of shorts while we're here. First, from the It Wasn't All Bad section. A 54-year-old college custodian who cleaned classrooms at night and studied engineering by day is putting down his janitor's broom for the last time. Michael Valdrill started working the night shift at Massachusetts Worcester Polytechnic Institute 8 years ago after his plastering business went under. He began taking classes, free for WPI employees, and last month graduated with a mechanical engineering degree. When the story of his perseverance made the national news, job offers poured in, and he has now accepted an engineering position at a Connecticut aerospace firm. Graduation was great, Vaudrill said, but to get the job was a complete satisfaction. And from the Only in America section, a California man who rescued a family from an overturned vehicle has been billed $143 by paramedics for making sure he was okay. First responders gave Derek Deanda a bottle of water and checked his pulse after he smashed a window and freed four trapped passengers last fall. "A couple of months later, I get a bill," Deanda said. "Makes you wonder why people don't want to stop to help at an accident scene." We're on the briefing page. It's titled Modern Day Slavery. Millions of people are still held in slavery around the world. Why does India have the most? How many are enslaved? Across the globe, nearly 46 million people are living in some kind of bondage. The most prevalent form of slavery is debt bondage, in which laborers are tied to an ever-growing debt, working long hours for no take-home pay. Sex slavery is also rife, with millions of women and girls sold into forced prostitution. In the shrimping industry, workers are kidnapped and forced to work on boats or in processing plants, unable to escape. India has by far the greatest number of enslaved people, according to the 2016 Global Slavery Index, with some 18 million Indians trapped in debt bondage or forced labor. The other countries with the most slave labor are China, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Uzbekistan. Americans unknowingly consume many products made by slaves, including seafood from Thailand, clothing from South Asian sweatshops, and smartphones fashioned from minerals from Congolese mines, Siddharth Kara, director of the program on human trafficking at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, said the products made by slaves and bonded laborers touch almost every aspect of the global economy, including frozen fish, tea, coffee, rice, wheat, diamonds, hand-woven carpets, salt, cigarettes, and sporting goods. How do people become slaves? Bonded labor usually starts with a simple debt. Harish, a man in West Bengal, India, borrowed about $110 from a local landowner in his village more than 20 years ago so he could marry his wife, Sarika. Some repayment arrangements involve a fixed term of labor, say 7 years, but others, like Haresh's, accrue interest at extortionate rates, and the laborer can never pay it off. "My entire family is still in debt to the landowner," Harish said. "Sarika and I work in the fields. My sons and their wives work at the brick kilns. One day my grandchildren will work for the landowner. We will only be free when we die." What work do slaves do? In India, bonded labor can be found in the textile industry, farming, and manufacturing, but perhaps the most egregious form is in brickmaking. India's caste system has created a huge labor pool of ethnic minorities and Dalits, the lowest or untouchable caste, who can't find legitimate jobs. These people are fodder for the quarry and brick kiln operators. It's brutal work. Laborers squat all day in mud, carving out bricks, while others heave the bricks into blazing kilns. They must live on site, paying their employers for food and rent. But since they aren't paid enough to cover those expenses, they are trapped into endless bondage. Their children work too, breaking coal for the kiln fires. And when the parents die, the kids inherit the ever-growing family debt. How many children are held in slavery? Nobody knows for sure, but in India alone, the total is in the millions. In addition to working in the brickyards, children weave carpets or sew, while others are forced to beg and turn over the proceeds. But the vast majority of child laborers work on farms. Until recently, India was making progress, getting children out of the fields and into school. In 2009, the government mandated free, compulsory primary education. But last year, the new government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi approved a law allowing children under 14 to work in family enterprises, arguing that poor families can't survive without everyone's labor. That loophole, though, is easily exploited. Kailash Satyarthi, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2014 for his efforts to end child labor, says that millions of children who are said to be working for their parents are actually sold into bonded labor. Many girls end up in sexual slavery. What does the Indian government say? It says it is doing its best. Last month, right after the Slavery Index came out, the government introduced a draft of a wide-ranging law to combat human trafficking. The law will provide shelters for victims and set up special courts to try traffickers. It also drafted a policy setting a minimum wage for domestic workers. But such laws are useless without proper enforcement, and that's where India lags. All Indian states, for example, are required to perform district-by-district surveys to identify those in bonded labor, but many states consistently report an implausible figure of zero cases. What can be done? The U.S. and U.K. have already passed laws forbidding the importation of slave-made goods, though they can be difficult to track. Last year, world governments pledged through the United Nations to end forced labor, human trafficking, and slavery by 2030. But Andrew Forrest, the Australian mining magnate who founded the anti-slavery foundation Walk Free, says government is just part of the solution. The real key, he says, is for business owners to demand to know the sourcing of each product in their supply chain. Forrest says he eliminated forced labor in his own mining concerns in exactly that way. It is time to draw a line and say no more. He says, this isn't AIDS or malaria. It is a man-made problem that can be solved. It's time to take real action to free the world from slavery once and for all. Turning girls into sex slaves. Human traffickers take young girls from their villages, promising their families the girls will get jobs as maids with good salaries. Gudi, a girl from a village near Kolkata, told activist Hazel Thompson, author of the sex slavery expose Taken, that she came to Mumbai at age 11 to be a domestic. Instead, she was brutally raped and beaten by a brothel owner and held in a windowless caged room. She was allowed out of the room only to eat and service customers. I am trapped on all sides, sister, Gudi said. My life was taken when they brought me here. Thousands of girls are trafficked each year in Mumbai alone. Even if such girls manage to escape, they know no life but prostitution, and their families consider them sullied and won't take them back. We have a special section in this edition called Summer Fiction, and it includes an article called How We Read Books Today. We'll start with that. And then it lists a good many new novels for summer 2016, and we'll take a look at a couple of those. So how we read books today. E-books were supposed to spell the end of print, but Americans' reading habits have taken an altogether different turn. Do most Americans still read books? 7 out of 10 American adults, or 72%, have read a book in the past year, in whole or in part, and in any format, according to a 2015 Pew Research Center survey. That's a steep decline from 1978, when 92% of Americans made that same claim, although book reading percentages have remained level since 2012. Women and young adults tend to be the biggest bookworms. The average woman read 14 books over the past 12 months, while men averaged 9 books. Among young adults aged 18 to 29, fully 80% read a book in the past year, compared with 71% of adults ages 30 to 49, 68% of those 50 to 64, and 69% of those 65 and older. How are people consuming their books? They've become hybrid readers, shifting between print, audiobooks, and digital books, depending on the situation. That's a big change from 6 years ago, when e-books, driven by the launch of the Kindle, the Nook, and the iPad, exploded in popularity to the point where publishing industry experts were forecasting the death of the print books. From 2008 to 2012, publisher revenue just from e-book sales jumped from $61.3 million to $1.54 billion. E-books accounted for an increasingly large share of the total trade revenue in that same time frame, climbing from 1.2% in 2008 to 22.5% in 2012. E-books were this rocket ship going straight up, Lynn Vlahos, a former executive director of the Book Industry Study Group, told the New York Times. Just about everybody you talked to thought we were going the way of digital music. Since then, however, e-book sales have largely been flat. In 2015, they totaled $1.37 billion and accounted for not quite 20% of total trade revenue. What happened? Consumers may be responding in part to the increased cost of e-books. Last year, publishers HarperCollins and Simon & Schuster renegotiated distribution deals with Amazon, winning the right to set the prices of their e-book titles and avoid the discounts Amazon often gave. Now many e-books cost as much as a paperback or even a hardcover. Since book buyers expect the price of a Kindle e-book to be well under $9, once you get over that $10, consumers start to say, let me think about that, Peter Hildekick Smith, CEO of publishing research from Codex, told the Wall Street Journal. The increased popularity of audiobooks, which can be downloaded through websites and subscription services like iTunes, Audible, and Scribd, also plays a role. Audiobooks accounted for the strongest portion of adult book sales in 2015, bringing in $205.6 million, a 38.9% increase from 2014, according to the AAP. The only other subsection of the adult books category that grew last year was trade paperbacks, boosted by the adult coloring book trend, which climbed 16.2%. to $1.4 billion in sales. Sales of all other formats were down, including e-books by 9.5%. Another measure of audiobook success is publishers' increasing output. The 20 companies that participated in an Audio Publishers Association survey released 35,574 audiobooks in 2015, a 37% increase over 2014. Who is listening to all these books? Younger readers and fiction fans make up a significant portion of the audience base. 55 million Americans listened to at least one audiobook in 2014, according to the Edison Research Survey. And one-third of respondents who characterized themselves as frequent audiobook listeners fell into that 25 to 34 age bracket. 85% of respondents said the most important factor in their decision to purchase audio was genre. Mysteries, thrillers, suspense was the most popular listening category, followed closely by history, biography, memoirs, and popular fiction. What are the advantages of audio? Some people simply prefer listening to text over reading it, but the quality of the performances is a significant factor. Often audiobooks feature talented voice actors or celebrities. Reese Witherspoon, for example, read Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman. Jake Gyllenhaal recorded The Great Gatsby. And Ian McKellen did The Odyssey. Some audiobook narrators have even developed the followings and star power to drive sales. For example, author Andrew Peterson hired the veteran audiobook narrator Dick Hill, who voices Jack Reacher in the best-selling thriller series by Lee Child, to narrate his debut novel. And it sold four times as much in audio as in other formats. This is a completely different phenomenon, a cultural and, frankly, aesthetic change in people's habits. Audible CEO Donald Katz told MarketWatch.com. Are there other benefits? Sure. Users can listen to books while working out, doing chores, and commuting, an especially big advantage if you travel by car. The apps that enable listening can be downloaded on your tablet or smartphone, potentially eliminating the need to carry something extra around. If efficiency is your game, audiobooks have set off a trend of speed listening, basically using the variable playback speeds offered by different software to increase the rate at which a narrator is talking. While opting for 1.5 times regular speed is most common, some people set it to as fast as 3 times the regular speed. But is something lost when listening to a novel narrated in a chipmunk-like tone? As podcast host Nate DeMeo told the Boston Globe, you can listen to Abbey Road at 45 RPM, but I'm sure George Martin and the Beatles would not appreciate it. And from our list of new novels of summer 2016, here's one titled Homecoming by Ya Gyasi. The ambitious first novel from 26-year-old Ya Gyasi has vaulted her into the ranks of the season's most anticipated new writers. This is a family saga spanning 7 generations, and it's steeped in nearly 300 years of African and American history. It opens in 18th century Ghana with half-sisters who are strangers to each other. Effia is married off to a wealthy British colonizer, while Essie is sold into slavery. One third of the story follows Effia's descendants through the centuries of warfare in Ghana. The other sees Essie and her progeny in the plantations of the American South, through the Civil War and Great Migration, into the jazz clubs of Harlem and on to the present. The book is more a well-made linked story collection than a complex epic, said Kirkus Reviews, yet Gyasi plainly has the talent to pull that off. It's a promising debut that's awake to emotional, political, and cultural tensions across the time and continents. That was Homecoming by Yaa Gyasi, G-Y-A-S-I. And from veteran writer Stephen King, End of Watch. The latest from supernatural suspense master Stephen King concludes the trilogy that began with the Edgar Award, winning Mr. Mercedes and Finders Keepers. While those books both honored and toyed with the conventions of hard-boiled crime fiction, King now steers back into the realm of horror that for sure belongs to him, said Kirkus Reviews. Retired Detective Bill Hodges is again after Bradley Hartsfield, a serial murderer known as the Mercedes Killer. Although in a hospital in a supposedly catatonic state, Hartsfield is freer than anyone realizes. He has acquired psychic powers and is persuading people to commit crimes. He even creates a hypnotic video game that compels users to kill themselves. Hartsfield's sights are set first on doing in Hodges and his sidekicks, then on unleashing a suicide epidemic. The novel is gleefully gross, and heavy machinery figures into both the crime and its cure. And suffice it to say that both are exceedingly messy. Here's a column from the technology section this week. Transportation. Where are our flying cars? Bold, some might say far-fetched, invention is alive and well in Silicon Valley, said Ashley Vance and Brad Stone in Bloomberg Businessweek. Unbeknownst to all but a handful of Silicon Valley insiders, Google co-founder Larry Page has been personally funding a pair of secretive California aerospace startups that hope to finally deliver on the ultimate nerd fantasy, the flying car. Page is said to have poured $100 million of his own money into Z.Aero, whose patent filings show a small, all-electric aircraft that can take off and land vertically. Municipal airport workers have even spotted tests of a strange-looking aircraft near the Z.Aero's hangar in Hollister, California. Meanwhile, a second Page-backed startup called Kitty Hawk is developing a competing flying car design resembling a giant version of a quadcopter drone. Page, who has been vocal about his desire to change the world outside the internet, wants the flying car future. And he wants it now. Page isn't alone, said Jonathan Gitlin in ArsTechnica.com. Dozens of companies around the world, from tiny startups to large aerospace firms, are working on designs for personalized air transportation. The necessary technology is advancing rapidly as well. Electric motors are getting smaller and lighter, while the explosion of consumer drones shows that we can make ungainly shapes fly well, even in the hands of amateurs, thanks to software. A few years ago, self-driving cars were just as much a fantasy as flying ones, said Devin Coldaway in TechCrunch.com. Now, pretty much everyone thinks they're inevitable. That's doubly good news for flying cars, because who do you expect will pilot them? It certainly won't be the human drivers who have already caused millions of traffic deaths on land without having to worry about things like pre-flight checks, restricted airspace, and air traffic control. The old joke about flying cars is that they're the future and always will be, said Will Knight in TechnologyReview.com. At this point, it would still require huge, heavy, and expensive batteries to carry a person through the air. And while the air may be easier for computers to navigate than busy roads, the necessary artificial intelligence would still need to be incredibly robust if passengers aren't meant to take over in the event of an emergency. The fact that flying cars act as a stand-in for some distant, unattainable future isn't a mistake, said Andrew Hawkins in TheVerge.com. Flying cars have captured the imagination of eccentric tycoons going back to Henry Ford. Yet every attempt to build one over the decades has fizzled. Maybe the problem is that even though flying cars look really cool, they don't actually solve any real-world problems. But if Page and his deep-pocketed peers want to turn this science fiction into a reality, more power to them. And while we're here, we'll go right into the health and science page, starting with an article titled Gun Violence, The Toll of Deadlier Weapons. Gun-related injuries have become more prevalent and increasingly deadly over the past decade, a new study has found, analyzing data on 29,000 patients treated at Denver Health Medical Center between 2000 and 2013. Researchers found that every 2 years, the death rate from gunshot wounds has increased by 6.5%, and the risk of suffering multiple bullet wounds has jumped by about 5%. These continuing increases reflect growing use of high-capacity magazines and powerful firearms, including military-style assault rifles like the one used by Orlando shooter Omar Mateen, researchers said. Our study provides an objective measure of something trauma surgeons across the country already know. The firearms used in our communities are becoming more harmful and more lethal, author Angela Saui of the University of Colorado tells LiveScience.com. 2 decades ago, most gunshot wounds doctors treated were caused by single bullets from Saturday night specials, cheap handguns with smaller caliber bullets and less power. But it is now common, researchers said, for shooting victims to have six or more severely damaging bullet wounds. More research is needed, the study said, but Congress has prohibited federal funding for studies on firearms-related fatalities and injuries. Seeking to overturn this 20-year NRA-backed ban, the American Medical Association last week labeled gun violence a public health crisis unrivaled in any other developed country. Greenhouse gas surge. Climate change crossed a grim threshold this year as concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere rose to 400 parts per million. The researchers say levels won't drop within the next century. This was the fastest annual CO2 increase since climate scientists began measuring carbon dioxide levels from Hawaii's Mauna Loa Observatory in 1958, and the first time concentrations of the gas exceeded 400 parts per million for an entire year. Driving the surge was a powerful El Nino event that dried tropical lands, slowed the growth of carbon dioxide-absorbing trees, and triggered wildfires that pumped the greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. These effects were exacerbated by human-induced emissions, which have increased by 25% over the past 2 decades. Carbon dioxide concentrations have risen steadily from a pre-industrial level of 280 parts per million, but haven't regularly exceeded 400 parts per million since 3 million to 5 million years ago, when water levels were up to 80 feet higher than they are today. Breaking the 400 barrier isn't going to trigger an immediate climate catastrophe, but researchers say it should be a wake-up call. As study author Richard Brett tells The Washington Post, it's a reminder of the long-term effects we're having on the system. Whole grains boost longevity. Eating whole grains like oats, quinoa, and brown rice can help you live longer, new research suggests. A meta-analysis of 14 long-term studies involving nearly 800,000 men and women found the people who ate three or more servings of whole grains each day had a 20% lower risk of dying early than those who ate none. NBCNews.com reports, having three servings of whole grains per day was also associated with a 25% lower risk of death from heart disease and a 14% lower risk of death from cancer than just one daily serving. There are many biological pathways that would explain why whole grains are beneficial, said study author Ki Sun of Harvard University's School of Public Health. Unlike white or refined grains that have been milled and stripped of their nutrients, whole grains contain the entire grain kernel, which provides fiber, iron, and several B vitamins. Fiber improves cholesterol levels, helps insulin sensitivity, and promotes satiety, the feeling of being full after eating, which reduces the risk for obesity-related health issues and stroke. We'll be right back. And it's time for our long-form piece, The Last Word. This week titled, You've Got a Rented Friend. Lonely Japanese often turn to paid professional pals to keep them company for a few hours. Writer Chris Collin travels to Tokyo to see how the faux friendships compare to the real thing. It's muggy and I'm confused. I don't understand where I am, though it was only a short walk from my Airbnb studio to this little curry place. I don't understand the lunch menu, or even if it is a lunch menu. I'm new in Tokyo and sweaty and jet-lagged, but I am entirely at ease. I owe this to my friend, Miyabi. She's one of those reassuring presences, warm and eternally nodding and unfailingly loyal, like she will never leave my side. At least not for another 90 minutes, which is how much of her friendship I've paid for. Miyabi isn't a prostitute or an escort or an actor or a therapist. For the past 5 years, she has been a professional rent-a-friend, working for a company called Client Partners. My lunchmate pokes daintily at her curry and speaks of the friends whose money came before mine. There was the head of a prominent company, rich and very clever, but conversationally marooned at hello. Discreetly and patiently, Miyabi helped draw out other words. There was the string of teenage girls struggling to navigate mystifying social dynamics. At their parents' request, Miyabi would show up and just be a friend. You know, a normal, companionable 27-year-old friend. She had been paid to cry at funerals and swoon at weddings, lest there be a shame over paltry turnout. Last year, a high schooler hired her and 20 other women just long enough to snap one grinning, peace sign flashing, I totally have friends Instagram photo. When I learned that friendship is rentable in Tokyo, it merely seemed like more Japanese wackiness in a subset I'd come to think of as interest kitsch. Every day in Japan, some weird new appetite is identified and gratified. There are cats to rent, after all, used underwear to purchase, owls to pet at owl bars. All this to say I expected something more or less goofy when I lined up several English-speaking rent-a-friends for my week in Tokyo. Contrived Instagram photos aside, Miyabi's career mostly comprises the small, unremarkable acts of ordinary friendship. Shooting the breeze over dinner, listening on a long walk, speaking simple kindnesses on a drive to the client's parents' house, simply to pretend you two are in love and absolutely on the verge of getting married. When she was a girl, Miyabi longed to be a flight attendant, and that tidy solicitousness still emanates. She wears a smart gray skirt and a gauzy beige blouse over which a sheet of impeccable hair drapes weightlessly. She smiles when I smile, touches my arm to make a point. Her graciousness cloaks a demanding job. With an average of 15 gigs a week, Miyabi's hours are irregular and bleed from day into night. The daughter of a doctor and a nurse, she still struggles to convince her parents that her relatively new field is legitimate. The money is fine, but not incredible. I'm paying her roughly $115 for 2 hours, some percentage of which Client Partners keeps. So why does she do it? Miyabi puts down her chopsticks and explains. It helps people. Real and lonesome people in need of, well, whatever ineffable thing friendship means to our species. So many people are good at life online or life at work, but not real life, she says, pantomiming someone staring at the phone. For such clients, a dollop of emotional contact with a friendly person is powerful, she adds, even with a price tag attached. So this isn't secretly about romance, I ask. Not at all, she replies. There are two rules. No romance, no lending money. Also, be ready for all types of clients. widowers who need someone to watch TV with, shy guys who could use a dating coach, shy gals longing for a shopping companion, and that one dude who just wanted a friend who'd do him the solid of waiting 7 hours outside Nike to snag those fresh sneakers for him when they went on sale. Then there are the fake boyfriends. At 35, Hayato had been facing intense pressure to find a wife and start a family, but it wasn't happening. So he started a charade instead. A visit to his parents' home was coming up, and with Miyabi's help, he concocted a whopper. That she was one of Hayato's employees at his company, and they had fallen in love. The two hunkered down in cafes to practice. Biographical details were learned, romantic quirks rehearsed. As long as she was telling lies, he decided some general flattery wouldn't hurt. Hayato's so great and kind at the company, everyone there loves him. The day of the visit came, and lo, the parents bought it. Soon the fake relationship fake graduated to a fake engagement. It was embarrassing, Miyabi told me about the lying. But watching his parents feel good when I said those nice things about him, it's not all bad. But all pretend good things come to an end, and eventually a finale was written. In time, a heartbroken Hayato informs his parents that Miyabi loved her career more than she loved him. She'd transferred to a different branch. And that was that. My friend Yumi is petite, with bird-like features made more bird-like by her human-scale fedora. She speaks good English but still wobbles, so her husband, Taka, joins us. They're one of those sweet and unassuming couples that exist just to radiate koala-like gentleness. The afternoon is steamy, and we're in the back of a tiny, dark iakaya in the city's jumbly Sanjinjaya neighborhood. It has been a day since Miyabi, the equivalent of a month in unmoored Tokyo time. I've walked through indomitably cute toy stores and narrow alleys thick with yakitori smoke. I am grateful for my pretend friend. As we nibble at pork with ginger, Yumi Ginger cheerfully tells me about the gigs she has had since joining Client Partners. The six-year-old agency is the largest of its kind in Japan, with 8 branches across Tokyo and another that recently opened in Osaka. There was the mystery writer who wanted her to read the novel he'd toiled away at for 10 years. Another man needed someone to talk with about his aging parents, not in person but via months of emails. Like Miyabi, Yumi works weddings. For one, she was hired to play the sister of the bride, a real living woman who was in a family feud that precluded her actual attendance. The mother of the bride was also a rental. The two imposters got along swimmingly. Yumi explains that these are just the more theatrical gigs. The bulk of her clients, they just want basic, uncomplicated companionship. From Yumi's vantage point, the breadth and depth of that need says something profound about her country. There's a word in Japanese, gaman, that translates roughly as stoic forbearance in the face of the unbearable. It's a deep-seated Japanese value, this idea that you suck it up no matter what. A lot has been happening lately. Anxiety and depression spiked after the Fukushima nuclear disaster. The country itself is shrinking, its population plummeting and aging rapidly. And there's the apparently growing problem of people who literally work themselves to death. A third of suicides have been attributed to overwork. All of that Yumi and Taka say, but you act like everything's fine. Enter the rent-a-friend. Not a miracle cure, no, but maybe a pressure valve. With us, Yumi says, people can talk about their feelings without worrying what their real friends think. After lunch, we roam a warren of 100 yen stores nearby. Before parting ways at the subway entrance, we ask someone to snap our photo. That funny kinship that forms in front of a camera. The arms around each other, the shared self-consciousness seems to happen for us too. Yumi writes her address in my notebook, draws a cartoon of herself in her fedora. Send me the picture, she writes beside it. It's almost as if she really meant it. On a drizzly Friday morning, my destination is the client partner's headquarters, a small but airy suite in a nondescript Shibuya District office building. I rope my translator in for this, and we're met by a round-faced woman in a long robe-like garment. Maki Abe is the CEO, and for the next hour, we sit across a desk from her and talk not about wacky interest kitsch, but about a nation's spiritual health. We look like a rich country from the outside, but mentally we have problems, Maki says. She speaks slowly, methodically. Japan is all about face. We don't know how to talk from the gut. We can't ask for help. So many people are alone with their problems and stuck, and their hearts aren't touching. Maki and I bowed when we met, but we also shook hands. She brings it up later. There are many people who haven't been touched for years. We have clients who start to cry when we shake hands with them. It's not that people lack friends, she says. Facebook, Instagram, scroll around and you find a country bursting with mugging, partying, companionship. It just isn't real, that's all. There's a real me and a masked me. We have a word for the lonely gap in between, kodoku. Maki attributes some of this to World War II. Spiritual consciousness was widespread before that, she says. Harmony and helping each other was the national spirit. Now we've got selfishness instead. I don't know. I've yet to encounter a country without a similar narrative. Things were better, now they're worse. Maybe the CEO of a friendship rental company can't help but see fissures in the psychic landscape. Or maybe the crisis is real. Regardless, Maki wants to fix it, one synthetic relationship at a time. Before we part, she stops me. Am I aware of client partner's ultimate goal? To render itself unnecessary, she says. My final friend, Yusuke, is a guy. He stands out with a big mop of hair, a goofy laugh, and old soul eyes. But when I meet him tonight, it's his maleness that distinguishes him most in a sea of female rent-a-friends. By day, Yusuke sells furniture to corporate offices, a job he concedes that involves moves similar to being a friend. Express curiosity, open up about yourself first. It's a show. But artifice and all, he's a sweet and unguarded sprite of a fellow. He lived in various countries as a student and honed that easygoing adaptability common among kids who bounce around. He expresses curiosity and opens up. We meet at the subway station in Yoyogi, and soon he's leading me down a dark, wet street to a rickety okonomiyaki joint. Within a few minutes, he's showing me how to cook our own savory pancakes on the tabletop stove between us. Like many Japanese people, he works 10-hour days, then often spends the rest of the night with those same colleagues, eating or drinking till all hours. Tonight, I gather, is a welcome break from that routine. We talk about childhood and relationships and aging. Because our temperaments align, or because we're both guys, conversation is easy. At one point, the waiter offers us drinks. Yusuke says no to alcohol on duty, and I realize I'd forgotten this was duty at all. I've paid for every word Yusuke has uttered, but I'm also convinced we've forged something genuine. Toward the end of our meal, Yusuke and I find ourselves both discussing our grandfathers. Both men served in World War II, ostensibly, I suppose, trying to kill one another, somewhere in the South Pacific. Each, we agree, had been deeply affected by those years. The sins of our respective countries might have plunged the meal into awkwardness, but in fact the opposite happens. In clumsily assuring each other of our good intentions, thoughtful questions, sympathetic nods, we plunge into a funny sweetness instead. When later we part ways, we agree to stay in touch, and though we won't, we'll mean it in that moment. In the weeks ahead, it will occur to me I'm grateful for all the elements, the smell of the pancakes, the talk of grandfathers, the wet pavement outside. Years from now, those things might just remind me of another wacky cultural phenomenon that took hold in Japan. Or they might summon the memory of this nice furniture salesman named Yusuke, a mop-headed guy who, for a couple of hours one night in Tokyo, started to become a friend. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Afar magazine. And we'll pick up some of the business articles this week. First, we'll take in a couple of columns. First one, how to value a CEO. How can you tell if a chief executive is overpaid? Asked Gretchen Morgenson. Most public companies link their CEO's pay package to the company's stock price. But a firm's stock can reach stratospheric heights even when its core business is being run into the ground. A better way to determine whether a CEO has created long-term value is to look at the firm's return on capital. This metric reveals how effectively a company is using its own money to generate profit in its operations. Shareholder Value Advisors, which specializes in effective CEO pay, examined 200 companies with the highest paid executives and compared each one's return on capital over the past 5 years with companies in the same industry. The study found that 74 of the companies overpaid their CEOs a total of $835 million last year, with the worst offenders in energy, technology, media, and healthcare. At Salesforce.com, for example, return on capital has fallen 23% over the past 5 years, but last year alone, CEO Mark Benioff received nearly $31 million more than was warranted by the company's performance against its peers. By contrast, MasterCard had a 40% premium on capital compared with its peers, making CEO Ajapal Banga's $15.5 million package seem like a bargain. America's workaholic nature. We Americans have a confused and contradictory relationship with vacation, said Robert Samuelson. Theoretically, we love taking time off. Yet about half of full-time workers who earn vacation time leave at least some of those days unused. From 1978 to 2000, full-time U.S. workers earned and used an average of 20 days of vacation every year, according to the travel industry, backed think tank Project Time Off. By 2015, they earned almost 22 days of vacation, but took only 16. The travel industry has labeled these employees work martyrs and argues that their inability to take a break costs the U.S. economy about $223 billion a year in lost spending on airlines, restaurants, theme parks, and other tourism businesses. When the organization asked people why they didn't take more vacations, 37% said they were afraid of returning to a mountain of work, while 30% believed no one else could do their job. Email and smartphones have also blurred the boundaries between home and office, making vacation less of a respite. Contrary to stereotypes of lazy millennials, young people were among the most fearful of leaving the office, with nearly a third saying they didn't want to be seen as replaceable. For better or worse, the American work ethic, often declared dead, endures. And the business news at a glance from the tech sector, Microsoft's budding marijuana biz. Microsoft is breaking the corporate taboo on pot, said Nathaniel Popper in the New York Times. The software giant announced this week that it will begin offering software that tracks marijuana plants from seed to sale, helping local governments in states that have legalized recreational or medical weed to keep tabs on commerce. The new software, part of Microsoft's growing cloud computing business, is a watershed for the fast-growing legal cannabis industry. Most big-name businesses have shied away from anything to do with marijuana because the drug is still considered illegal by the federal government. America's upper middle class is larger and richer than it's ever been, controlling about 52% of the country's income. The share of households earning between $100,000 and $350,000 for a family of three doubled from roughly 13% of the population in 1979 to nearly 30% in 2014. The middle class accounts for 32% of the population and controls 25.8% of the income. Despite the growing popularity of maternity leave policies, many American men are reluctant to take advantage. In a recent Deloitte survey, more than a third of respondents said taking time off after the birth of an infant would jeopardize their position. More than half said it would signal a lack of commitment at work. We have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.